and undesirable choices. One, she could go away to a school that offered enormous benefits, both socially and academically, but entailed living in a dorm and coming home only every few months. Or two, staying home, but losing the advantages of the distant school. She hated both ideas and wasted valuable weeks insisting that there must be a better third way. Often a better third way can be found, but sometimes, including this occasion, no third alternative exists. My daughter simply could not wrap herself around the idea that she would have to do something she really dreaded, because she dreaded the alternative as well. Although my wife and I were gratified that she saw being at home with us and her siblings in such a positive light, we realized that the most important lesson of the choice was for her to mature and realize that sometimes you must go with the least bad of the available choices. In business, constant innovation along with creative destruction is often the least bad of the choices. Whether it is firing employees, pulling the plug on a project, or leaving behind a safety net to try a new field, we must be comfortable with the idea that even positive change will most times have negative components. This trend, whereby the market spits out older companies that don't adapt to change, has been an ever-accelerating phenomenon. For example, consider these statistics. Of the 500 companies that made up the Standard & Poor's S&P 500 in 1957, only 74 remained on the list through 1997. In 1926, the S&P 500 had a turnover rate of about 1.5%. That meant that a company stayed on the list for an average of 67 years. In those days, three generations of a family could have worked for the same company their entire working lives. By 2000, the turnover on the S&P 500 was about 10%, meaning that the average company life cycle on the S&P index is more like 12 years. Not only couldn't your parents and your children work for the same company all their working lives, but you couldn't either. The German economist Joseph Schumpeter, who later became a respected teacher at Harvard, explained this process of what he called creative destruction in 1942. The way he put it was that the constant march forward to ever newer ways of doing things was not just a lamentable side effect of commerce, but was an essential element of wealth creation. The task of creating wealth absolutely depends on change. The old Soviet Union was a marvelously preserved museum of 19th century industrialism. This was not because it lacked capital. One need only recall the vast sums it pumped into its side of the arms race. The Soviet Union was the first to launch a space satellite, the famous Sputnik in 1957, and it even had access to new technology. However, the one thing it would not do was to close old-fashioned and unprofitable factories. Here's how economist Edward Luttwak so clearly put it. A brand new automobile plant would be imported from Italy, complete with assembly lines, hand tools, and training. But right alongside that plant, where modern cars came off efficient production lines, other plants employing 10 times as many employees turned out ancient models. There was innovation aplenty, but there was no way for it to spread, because the up-to-date plant lacked the power to invest more capital and hire more workers. Both had been pre-assigned. With no competition, obsolete factories just stayed in business forever. There was no junked machinery and no unemployment. But the overall result was to leave the population in poverty, squandering the world's largest store of natural resources along with immense amounts of capital and the skills and talents of a vast labor force. This does not mean that individuals need to blindly invest in or convert to the latest technology. Although the successes become famous, they are often built on the debris of earlier failure. Eventually, much money will be made via the Internet. It won't only be eBay or Amazon, but countless other companies as well. When this does happen, you must remember that the success would never have come had the earlier attempts not been launched and then allowed to fail. No, investors certainly do not need to always lurch from one new thing to another, even newer thing. Success does require keeping an eye on the world at large, regardless of your own particular field of endeavor. Especially in this time of universal communication, no one can afford to say, "I'm a physician, so what is going on in the computer industry is irrelevant to me." Or, "I run a dress store. Why do I need to know about the latest medical breakthrough?" Just as the buggy whip maker was affected by the arrival of the car, as was every citizen of the world, you are going to be affected by the implementation of plans that you may not even be able to picture today. You need the ability to let go of the old, in these cases, and to embrace the new. Not being taken by surprise is a great benefit. You ought to cling to the firm pilings of the unchangeable, and resist being swept away by the maelstroms that swirl around your very foundations. Change can be frightening and painful. Incremental change is easier to accept. Jewish tradition calls for a bride and groom to celebrate their wedding for 7 days. This is because it is plainly unreasonable to expect a young couple to experience this life-changing event and then on the very next day simply return to normality. Whereas Western culture presents the couple with a honeymoon, the Jewish system sees an isolated vacation in the Bahamas as a pleasurable but false picture of married life. Instead, while settling into their new apartment and getting accustomed to being seen in public together, a new husband and wife enjoy small parties hosted by friends and relatives for a full week following their marriage. A marriage is so profound, and it is to be hoped so permanent, that it requires 7 days for the human organism to return to normal. Another life-changing event is losing a close relative. Obviously, the death of a family member is both profound and permanent. That makes it stressful. And once again, Jewish tradition believes that the human organism is not constructed to go safely from, say, a father's funeral directly to a shopping mall or to a corporate staff meeting. Once again, the process is seen to require 7 days. And so, following the funeral, Jewish mourners commence a full week of stay-at-home recovery, being visited by friends of theirs and the deceased. This way, they are able to follow a gradual slope from change and emotional turbulence back to normality. This concept, that the human body and psyche needs time to adjust to drastic change, is an example of an unchanging truth represented by one of the triangles in the Star of David. It is not surprising that modern science bears out this reality. In 1986, Science magazine reported that heart attacks tended to occur in the morning, clustering at about 9 a.m. This discovery came about by accident. In the spring of 1984, James Muller of Harvard Medical School was presenting data from a clinical trial on heart disease. Someone in the audience commented that from Muller's data, it looked as though heart attacks were more likely in the winter than in summer. Muller thought that plausible. It certainly fit the image of the middle-aged man who has a heart attack while shoveling snow. Muller decided to review the data to see if the observation was correct. It wasn't. Heart attacks were equally likely to occur at all times of the year. but there was something peculiar about the timing of the heart attacks. He found that they tended to occur around 9 a.m. Why 9 a.m.? Because that is when most people are either fighting traffic on their way to work, or just starting to fight the challenges of work at their workplaces. Yet, people fight traffic and need to face the challenges at home in the evening as well. Therefore, shouldn't there be two clusters, corresponding roughly to morning and evening rush hours? No, because there is one major distinction between the two times of day. For most people, the period leading up to 9 a.m. is only minutes rather than hours, since they were horizontal and resting. The human was not designed for instantaneous change. Many people in the morning move from bedroom repose to racing for the train to work within less than a half an hour. That is plainly not healthful. The change between dream-filled sleep and the harried reality of work is so violent that it must be made gradually. And indeed, Jews have the perfect buffer zone, a brief prayer service of about 45 minutes each morning, right between the two contrasting conditions of restful sleep and combating traffic on the commute to work. You may not be interested in morning prayer, but there are other effective ways for you to place a buffer between waking and working. How about setting aside 20 minutes each morning to do nothing but contemplate all that is good in your life and for which you owe gratitude? This should happen even before working out and breakfast. My son supplied me with yet another example of the body's intolerance for the step function change. As an ardent scuba diver, he knows that as one descends deeper underwater, the air supplied by the scuba, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, gear, increases in pressure to combat the increased pressure on one's chest and lungs from the weight of the water. This increased pressure allows air to dissolve into the blood, just as it does at the surface, under normal conditions. A problem, often fatal, develops when a diver ascends too rapidly without pausing for decompression stops. In just the same way that the dissolved carbon dioxide bubbles out of soda as you suddenly yank off the bottle cap, air starts bubbling out of the diver's blood as he surfaces. This painful and dangerous condition is called the bends, and is only avoided by a slow and gradual ascent. People can handle almost anything, as long as it comes on gradually enough. Make changes gradually whenever possible. Understanding this concept allows me, as both an employee and an employer, to handle change in the workplace more effectively. Clearly, change can make people most uncomfortable, even unhealthy. Equally clearly, there are better and worse ways to cope with change. So be intensely aware of when you are inflicting stress-inducing rapid change on others. On occasion, you will elicit an entirely unexpected response from a person to whom you merely made an innocent announcement, or to whom you issued a routine instruction. Often, it will be because you underestimated or even ignored entirely the major change your announcement or directive caused in the person's life. For example, you may not think that minimally changing working hours or even putting in a new computer system is a big deal. But it may be a very big deal for an employee. There is a much greater chance of positive cooperation if you can present the information in a gradual manner rather than as a terse notice. Needless to say, making things as gradual as possible is advice that does not apply when surgery is taking place. In the same way that surgery necessary for the amputation of a limb is not drawn out over several months to minimize shock to the system, so it is that the termination of one or several people is best handled decisively. People often sense approaching threats, And in such circumstances, not only is a lengthy period of uncertainty cruel, but it can also be perilous for the organization. React to sudden change slowly, too. When you are on the receiving end of a sudden change, you are seldom under any obligation to respond while your soul is still coping with the initial stress and still trying to adjust. For example, suppose your boss has just informed you that your position is terminated, or that the company is going under. Or imagine that your daughter has just told you, with an exaggerated air of calmness and normality, that she is abandoning her college studies to elope. Perhaps your banker has just told you that because of a recently announced lawsuit against your company, the bank is closing your firm's $5 million line of credit. In each of these situations, even if you do not instantly feel stressed, recognize that you are stressed. The best response is not to respond. Instead, you could just say something like this. Well, you have obviously had a few days or hours, if appropriate, to think about how you were going to tell me this. I must now take the same period to consider my response to what you have just told me. More than one person, I can assure you, has consulted with me after responding impetuously to these types of situations. Family relationships can be irreparably ruined. You can walk away from a job termination with far less than you could have obtained with a more judicious response. And you can end up negotiating from a position of more serious weakness than was necessary. Don't have responses to sudden change forced on you if you can possibly avoid it. Being alert can keep change from being a sudden surprise as well. Workers at Kmart had years to contemplate the company's declining fortunes in the face of the super retailers like Walmart. Those who lost their jobs during early 2002 were not nearly as shocked as were the Enron workers who lost their jobs 3 or 4 months earlier when the energy giant imploded. In the case of Enron, it was almost overnight that the company went from high-flying, high-spending, high-profile Texas darling to doomed and disgraced skeleton. It is extremely rare for there not to be clues that major upheaval is coming. Many people prefer to put their heads in the sand rather than to have to begin to cope with something they would hope would just disappear. However, a far more effective strategy is to deal with these cataclysms on your own timetable, rather than that of someone else's choosing. Discomfort with change makes the familiar welcome. People love the familiar because it reassures them that nothing is changing. Cartoons of Mickey Mouse are perennial favorites. Mickey doesn't change. He remains impervious to the ravages of time. Harvard professor Stephen Jay Gould has pointed out that from Mickey's original debut in Steamboat Willie in 1928, Mickey's appearance had actually changed, though in a way that made him more familiar. Disney must have realized that most people tend to be sentimental about children and fond of them, so he found ways to make Mickey appear more childlike. The anatomical distinctiveness of infants comes from a head that is disproportionately large for their bodies, and also from large eyes. These features tend to produce a response of disarming tenderness in most adults. So Disney artists removed all sharp angularity from Mickey Mouse, giving him a disproportionately large head along with his large eyes. And his ears became more rounded and moved further back on his head. Not only was Mickey not going to change, but he was also going to look more and more familiar by looking more childlike. Discomforting change was avoided, and people flocked to animated films. Sometimes Suffering terrible changes through one's early years can teach how much people yearn for stability and predictability. For example, Frank Lowy was a 15-year-old Czechoslovakian Holocaust survivor when World War II ended. The war had robbed him of his childhood and of his innocence. He turned his back on his shattered past and haunting memories of horror, and joined the Jewish underground, fighting for independence in what would soon become the State of Israel. Understanding that nothing remains the same, and that eventually the fighting would end, he prepared for whatever the future would bring. He studied accounting at night, and after emigrating to Australia in 1951, he began delivering sandwiches for a deli in Sydney while saving his money and buying vacant suburban lots and subdividing them. In 1955, he visited California and saw his first shopping mall. So he returned to Australia, determined to bring this new change in the way people shop to his adopted country. By 1974, he had become Australia's dominant owner of shopping malls. Today, he is among the wealthiest men in Australia and is a confidant of politicians, including former Prime Minister Bob Hawke. He is also a member of Australia's Central Bank Board. With Australia conquered, Frank turned to the United States. He bought and built shopping centers until he owned 8 in San Diego, 8 in Los Angeles, 4 in Northern California, and 5 in St. Louis, Missouri, where he was the city's biggest landlord. In 1998, he began branding all his malls, renaming them all Westfield Shopping Towns. Each mall was to have the same signage and the same red, white, and blue uniforms for security guards, information booth attendants, and other personnel. Why the branding? Says Frank Lowy, for the same reason that McDonald's brands its hamburgers, a customer in San Diego can expect the same product as one in Washington, D.C. He wants his malls worldwide to be known for the same high quality of service. He thinks this consistency of experience will play well in a country where people are always on the move, constantly changing jobs and homes. This concept is clearly applicable to your life, both business and personal. Especially when great change is happening in one area, you should try your hardest to focus on familiarity and consistency elsewhere. In contrast to other cultures, Judaism embraces change. The problem with change is, of course, that life is seldom accommodating enough to telegraph us adequate advance warning of impending change. When the travail caused by that change arrives suddenly, you find yourself ill-equipped to cope, experience energy-sapping stress, and make mistakes. Therefore, a worldview that recognizes the benefits of change, as does Judaism, is of great value. While clinging relentlessly to those areas where change mustn't be accepted, Jews have tended to view the concept of change in a fundamentally healthful way. The cities of Athens and Jerusalem represented the cultural differences between Jewish philosophy and Hellenism, the other dominant culture of the 2nd century BCE. In contrast to Athens, which denied change by glorifying eternal youth, Jerusalem venerated age and the wisdom that often accompanies it. The Greek philosophy of Athens depicted a changeless world that was always here. In contrast, Judaism, through the Bible, depicted a world that instantaneously came into being through a primeval, cataclysmic Big Bang, the original giant change that made all else possible. Greece expressed an aristocratic disdain for work, whereas Judaism viewed work as human beings' partnership with God in the ongoing process of creation. It is almost impossible to overestimate the fact that that transcendent conviction can have on a culture or indeed on an individual. It can surely be no accident that approximately 80% of all the scientific and medical advances of the past 1,000 years have taken place in Christian societies. It may seem strange to hear an Orthodox rabbi identifying Christendom as the source of most of the technological developments that have so improved life. However, in reality, the source is not Christianity per se, but a transcendent conviction that Judaism and Christianity both share. Unlike many faiths that have mysterious and colorful accounts of the origins of the world, or those philosophies that utterly ignore the question of how humanity came to occupy this spot in the cosmos, both Judaism and Christianity depend for an answer on the 8 words that open all of Scripture. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. Why was it Isaac Newton, a devout Christian, who laid the foundations of modern physics, rather than, say, a thinker from some other culture? It is simply because Newton, who wrote extensive religious treatises well before he published Principia Mathematica in 1687, possessed a crucial transcendent conviction that if, indeed, an omnipotent and benevolent God created the universe, then it would be natural for him to have created it according to a recognizable pattern and according to fixed rules. Those rules are merely the materialistic equivalent of the spiritual rules disclosed in his book. That means, therefore, that searching for those patterns and rules should yield results. Unlike a member of a culture who supposes creation to have been random and capricious, Newton was motivated to launch his investigations by a conviction that what he sought did indeed exist. In similar ways, transcendent convictions about the nature of money and how it relates to change would also endow those who hold those convictions with superior chances of success. In his poem, Ode on a Grecian Urn, the poet John Keats expressed adoration for the painted lovers on the urn, because, unlike their real-life counterparts, these wouldn't age. Thinking of the consistent contrast between the worldviews symbolized by Athens and Jerusalem, respectively, I am always amused by one outstanding example of that contrast. Judaism appreciates gray hair as a symbol of experience, character, and wisdom, whereas the commercially available preparation that conceals gray hair and returns it to its original characterless color is sold under a brand name that alludes to the Grecian origin of the never-mature philosophy. My father always spoke of his love for each of his gray hairs. Each served as an eloquent reminder coming at him from his mirror each morning, he said, of how important it was to make every present moment count. Integrating change and the unchangeable into your life. You can prosper by integrating into your life the things that must never change, along with an openness to the things that can and should change. Turning change into an ally helps companies adjust to technological advances, and failing to do so hurts them. Likewise, using change correctly can help you, and failing to do so can hurt you. Change produces opportunity for business professionals. Think of the fashion industry, for example. You may not think it makes sense for men and women to discard perfectly good clothing just because it is no longer in fashion. Their doing so, nonetheless, stimulates fabric manufacture, photographers, designers, fashion magazine publishers, and many other workers in supporting industries. and the desire for those new clothes stimulates customers to spur themselves on to greater efforts of productivity to everyone else's benefit. That is how they can afford those new clothes. In any event, as you shall see later, for humans, clothing has always been far more than merely utilitarian. The ancient Jewish source for learning about how economic productivity always depends on change is the blessing that Moses gave to Zebulun. Rejoice, O Zebulun, in your breaking out, and Issachar in your tents. Traditionally, Zebulun is understood to have been the entrepreneurial representative of commerce and business among the 12 sons of Jacob. Breaking out means escaping conventional ways of thinking and common ways of doing things. Moses blessed Zebulun by telling him that he was preordained to lead the children of Israel in the areas of business and commerce, and that as such, he would need to know how to always break out of his present comfort zone. The lesson there is to always prepare for change. Expect the unexpected, plan on it, and profit from it. In areas having to do with wealth creation, never, never expect the status quo to be maintained. Your job next year will not resemble your job this year. If it does, either your employer is not thriving, or your position in the company is not secure. Either way, your days are numbered. If things are going well, you will be doing different things or more things. Perhaps you will be using tools and machinery that don't yet exist. Maybe you should prepare yourself for that. It is interesting that the closing phrase of the blessing Zebulun received prior to the aged leader's death is, "By the riches of the sea will they be nourished, and by the treasures concealed in sand." I recall being taught by one of my elderly rabbinic relatives during the 1960s that the sea is a metaphor for travel and trade. He added that the mysterious reference to treasures concealed in sand alluded to a future time when people would derive enormous wealth from very complex products made with sand. He explained that God was guiding humanity to a lesser dependence on matter and a greater dependence on mind. Thus, he intended to show humanity that wealth did not lie merely in rare and expensive gold, but also in plentiful and cheap sand, provided that sand was leveraged by human creativity. In 1962, what would you have thought if you had been told that before the end of the century, a great company called Intel would arise and produce incalculable wealth from products called chips, made almost entirely from sand, or that one of the wealthiest spots on the planet would be named Silicon Valley, where sand is mostly composed of the element silicon. The more things change, the more you must depend on things that never change. If Zebulun is linked to wealth creation, what is the meaning of the partnership with his brother Issachar, which is suggested by their linkage in the blessing? The blueprint is found in the verse just discussed. Rejoice, O Zebulun, in your breaking out, and Issachar in your tents. Jewish tradition describes a special relationship between the two brothers, Zebulun and Issachar. Theirs was to be a mutually dependent relationship. As always, everything God does has to do with enhancing human ability to interact peacefully and productively. One mechanism for achieving his purpose is, of course, money. The brothers' mutually interdependent relationship started off with Zebulun providing the economic wherewithal to support his brother Issachar. This left Issachar free of monetary concerns, so he could dedicate himself to his own vital purpose. Issachar's reciprocal role was to become a repository and to provide access to the moral and philosophical framework without which Zebulun's efforts would be ultimately doomed. In other words, business success depends on change and on readiness to embrace change. However, and this is a great big gigantic however, one can only feel truly free to embrace change, and one will only succeed in dealing with change if one is solidly anchored to a set of almost Cartesian-like coordinates that never change. James Collins, author of Built to Last, puts it this way. He asked readers to imagine the President of the United States holding a memo in his hands that reads, "We no longer hold these truths to be self-evident. We can no longer afford to hold the belief that all men are created equal." Glancing down at his memo, the Commander-in-Chief says, "We need to take a hard look at the Bill of Rights. We certainly can't let those outdated values get in our way. We cannot allow obsolete notions such as freedom of religion, freedom of the press, and the right to trial by jury to inhibit our drive toward progress. We must change and adapt to changing times." Collins pointed out how many of the most successful companies have conducted massive changes and adaptations while never abandoning their core values. For example, Disney almost religiously preserves its core value of wholesome entertainment. When it did decide to produce material that didn't fit its pattern, it created or purchased another production company like Miramax, through which to market controversial entertainment without tainting the Disney brand. To what extent this strategy has entirely succeeded, I am not quite sure yet. But Disney certainly understood the danger of ignoring this principle. Boeing is another example. It recently moved its headquarters from Washington State to Chicago without modifying its unchangeable value of leading-edge aviation technology and product integrity. Its core value system even underpinned a more dramatic change back in the 1950s. Then, Boeing depended for 80% of its business on military acquisition and focused almost single-mindedly on fighters and bombers. By remaining anchored to its core values, Boeing was able to bet the company on commercial jets. You will remember the debut of commercial jet aviation with the arrival of Boeing's famous 707. During 2001, Boeing supplied 527 commercial jets to the airlines of the world, which figure constituted 62% of all airplanes sold in the world that year. Boeing broke out of the confines of its box quite dramatically, but retained fealty to its unchangeables. Some things should never change. Profit is a core value. Temporarily forgotten was another area in which some things never change, the role of profit in a business. Just when things were changing at a dizzying pace during the 1980s and 1990s, business ought to have depended more certainly than ever on the unchanging role of profit. Consider this case study, the Ginnewish family. In the 1970s, a Holocaust survivor named Isaac Ginnewish and his wife Leah started a jewelry business in Montreal. They began by buying pearl necklaces from Asia and selling them to department stores for $100 when their competitors were charging $800. They were profitable from day one. In the summer of 1999, their four sons, who were all rabbis as well as old economy entrepreneurs, decided to join the new economy by starting an internet jewelry store they called BuyJewel.com. Back then, a gold fever atmosphere surrounded any enterprise with .com after its name, so you won't be surprised to hear that Goldman Sachs soon offered the brothers $10 million in seed funding for the fledgling company. They turned that offer down. But in November 1999, they met with e-commerce guru Bill Gross, his brother Larry, and other Idea Lab executives in Pasadena, California. Idea Lab was a high-tech incubating firm. The day of that meeting, the share price of one Idea Lab company, eToys, reached an all-time high of $52.50. The next day, another Idea Lab company, Tickets.com, went public, and its shares closed $7.50 above the initial offering price. Breathing the very air around Idea Lab was intoxicating. Bill Gross and his Idea Lab were flying high, and they acquired a majority of BuyJewel.com for several million dollars. By April 2000, the Ginowishes had moved to Los Angeles, and the company, now renamed ICE.com, was ensconced in the flamboyant Idea Lab office, which was decorated in a style meant to emulate the solar system, with Bill Gross managing from the sun's position in the center. From their parents, the Ginowish brothers had learned to infuse their work with equal parts business acumen and spiritual values. They felt that the office was as good a place as the synagogue for a spiritual lesson. Mayor Ginowish's wife, Naomi, put it this way, "For us, business and religion are one thing." This may be what helped insulate them from all the dot-com mania. For instance, when America Online offered the brothers advertising banner space for the bargain price of $70 million, they didn't bite. "How the hell do people have the chutzpah to ask for so much?" asked Mayor Ginowish. "De Beers doesn't spend $70 million on advertising, and they do billions of dollars in sales." Nonetheless, the brothers were spending, or burning, as Internet startup nomenclature would have it, nearly $500,000 a month in exchange for monthly sales of under $100,000. Because they understood the principle of those things that never change, they knew something was wrong and were particularly chagrined to have spent $40,000 to photograph some unknown models with the company's jewels for the website illustrations. During the second half of 2000, the free spending culture of Idea Lab and that of the conservative and religious Gowinishes collided. "We need to make money," Shmuel Ginowish recalls saying repeatedly. "We were hoarse from repeating ourselves. We need to make money." Monthly sales were up to $200,000, but ICE.com was still losing money. By fall 2000, ICE.com competitors like Miadora.com and Jewelry.com had failed, taking nearly $50 million of venture capital with them. They were obviously less obsessed with profit. In fact, almost nobody spoke of profit in those heady days. It was considered a little gauche to mention profit. Market share was king. But the Ginowishes, with their spiritual roots, knew the difference between things that change and things that don't. So the brothers relocated their families and their business away from the heady atmosphere of Los Angeles back to their parents' home in Montreal. Moving the office into an old building their parents owned and replacing Californian programmers with Canadian tech experts, they cut their burn rate down to about $100,000. And 2 months later, they turned their first profit. Having been steeped in the ancient Jewish wisdom of the Torah, the Ginowishes saved their company by remembering that limitless capital raised from investors does not mean the same thing as profit from customers. They knew that some things never change. Businesses that don't do something valuable for others do not survive and should not survive. Profit is a way to measure how useful a business is. That doesn't ever change. Evaluating when change is necessary because of new circumstances. Some things change and others do not. By the evening of that terrible Tuesday, September 11, 2001, most Americans were shaking their heads saying that nothing would ever be the same again. They were wrong, of course, understandably wrong, but still wrong to think that the attack changed everything in life. It changed a lot of things, but not everything. The sheer magnitude of that appalling act of cruelty certainly overwhelmed the immediate ability of Americans to analyze its effects. Much time would elapse before it became plain that some things like air travel would change indefinitely, whereas other things like grocery sales would remain exactly the same. People always need to buy food. That does not change. On September 12, airline executives threw themselves into redesigning air travel and restructuring their companies, and they were quite right to do so. Supermarket chains, lawn service firms, and pest exterminators would have been wrong to count on any major changes to their industries. Business must learn to be deliberate about change. Understanding what is essential and what isn't allows one to more effectively cope when unexpectedly assaulted by change. Consider the case of the Pacific Coast Biscuit Company in the early years of the 19th century. Pesach, or Passover, is one of the most widely observed Jewish holidays. Its most famous symbol is the food staple utterly unique to this holiday, a dry and somewhat indigestible cracker called matzah. Today, many food companies manufacture reliably kosher matzah for the Passover holiday. But back in 1916, far fewer matzah manufacturers existed. One of the best was the Pacific Coast Biscuit Company in Portland, Oregon. Each year, as spring approached, successive issues of the Jewish Tribune of Portland would carry advertisements for Pacific Coast Biscuit Company's matzah. Beneath a large, conspicuous swastika was the headline, "This trademark stands for supreme quality." Beneath that, the advertisement read, "Wherever you see the famous swastika sign, just remember its significance to the fathers and its present meaning. Then it meant brightness and prosperity. Today it is a symbol of purity and quality." Matzahs, when sealed in a carton with his trademark, a small swastika, is pure, clean, and wholesome beyond compare. When buying matzahs, this trademark is your surety of purity. Pacific Coast Biscuit Company, Portland, Oregon. Talk of change being thrown at you. Imagine being the proprietor of the Pacific Coast Biscuit Company and its prized swastika trademark in 1921, only 5 years after this advertisement appeared. It was in that year that Hitler's new red banner was unfurled for the first time. Yet, in reality, although changing a logo is expensive, it doesn't truly change the values that a company has. It is a cosmetic rather than a core change. For instance, soon after Anderson Consulting broke away from Arthur Anderson in August 2000, it changed its name to Accenture. Although this was merely cosmetic at the time, the change turned out to be fortuitous, allowing the international consulting firm to escape name association with Arthur Anderson's death throes during the Enron scandal. Companies and individuals that attempt to ignore unchangeable truths end up losing in the long run. Certainly, honesty in business falls into this category, as the 2001 debacle at Enron illustrates. Some people mistakenly assume that a transaction can only take place if one side withholds information from the other. They assume that a transaction constitutes one party outsmarting another. This is a failure to understand that when two parties sculpt a true transaction, it is not one party taking away something from the other, but two parties cooperating to create entirely new wealth. The transaction is more likely to take place if both parties understand that nothing needs to be hidden. Furthermore, the transaction is more likely to be successful if each party trusts the other and feels confident that no material facts are being withheld. This might be one reason for the success enjoyed by retailer Walmart, says Chris Olinger, Chief Executive of Service Industry Research Systems Incorporated. When trust is an issue, Walmart always wins. Trust is probably their largest merchandising weapon. Another unchangeable truth is that although human beings will often put their home lives aside and work 18-hour days, 7 days a week, for a limited amount of time, sooner or later the most dedicated employee will want a life. In the early entrepreneurial phases of a company, the almost palpable excitement and atmosphere of limitless promise can intoxicate employees. They will work long hours, often for little more than a promise. In the long run, and all wise business management takes the long run into account, encouraging employees toward full balance between personal and business lives will help to ensure low turnover. Sometimes these unchangeable truths don't mesh with the conventional wisdom of the day. Although we have all gone to great trouble during past decades to decree that male and female employees should be treated as if they were all gender neutral, Jewish wisdom would suggest that this idea, carried to an extreme, can be perilous. Talmudic wisdom suggests that because of the unmistakable power of human sexuality, men and women should never allow themselves to be secluded alone with a fellow worker of the opposite gender. This seemingly quaint worldview would suggest leaving the door to one's office ajar when meeting a coworker, and if on a business trip, getting together at a coffee shop rather than one's hotel suite. This caution serves a dual purpose. First, it provides protection against unwarranted sexual harassment charges, as well as not providing opportunity for actual misconduct. Second, it serves as a reminder that company policies against office romances are by definition limited. Whereas one company may ban such relationships entirely, and another allows them with certain restrictions, the reality of the world is such that I need to be aware of the temptation both for myself and, if I am the boss, for my employees. Pretending that personal relationships in the workplace can simply be ruled out of existence may lead to crises. Remember how casual clothing overtook much of U.S. business during the 1990s? "Things are so different now," chortled junior associates as they ambled into work in their dungarees and sandals. Well, after a 10-year excursion into clothing styles that hurt corporate image, encouraged slacking off, and fostered an environment ripe for sexual harassment, companies are asking workers to dress up rather than down. For the first time in 10 years, the year 2000 saw the number of companies permitting casual attire dropping. In 1998, 97% of companies in a Society for Human Resource Management poll allowed staffers to dress casually once a week. By 2000, that number had shrunk to 87%. In a survey of 1,000 firms conducted by Jackson Lewis, employers were asked whether they had noticed an increase in absenteeism and tardiness after instituting a casual dress policy. Nearly half said yes, and 30% reported a rise in flirtatious behavior. At Federated Investors in Pittsburgh, a traditional dress code requires women to wear skirts, nylons, and dress shoes. Men must wear suits and ties. The Chicago Board of Trade requires men on the floor to wear shirts with a collar and a tie. After experimenting in 1999 with casual dress, executive search firm Korn Ferry International returned to business attire with a memo that spelled out the firm's return to a suit and tie dress code, in response to a more traditional business environment. Clothing styles do change. Elizabethan gentlemen look nothing like their contemporary brethren do today. Casual clothing becomes acceptable and even chic. However, a few years go by, and once again things revert to basics. It may have had something to do with the White House of President George W. Bush, which has a dress code dictating jackets and ties and no jeans, even on weekends. This was in marked contrast to the Clinton administration's laid-back attitude. But certain principles do not change, and remaining aware of these principles, even anchored by them, grants a certain amount of freedom. Why should a man presenting himself for a potentially career-enhancing interview dress in a suit and tie rather than in shorts and a T-shirt? The would-be employer wants to see how willing the candidate will be to subordinate his own comfort to the discipline and demands of the job. Appearing in a suit that is obviously less comfortable than casual clothing, and one that certainly took more effort to don than a one-piece mechanic's overalls would have done, sends a clear, although perhaps subconscious message, I can take it. Furthermore, Jewish tradition explains that for society to function safely, men must lose some of their adolescent individualism. Wearing clothing similar to that worn by all other men on the train into the office is a little like soldiers in an army all wearing the same uniform. The system just works better if men see themselves as team players rather than as unique chest beaters bellowing out the sounds of their special importance. Even women's clothing in the workplace loses a little of the individuality it ordinarily displays in a social context. Can change be frightening? It certainly can, but it can also be exhilarating. It allows business to create wealth, as changing conditions create new opportunities. Above all, clinging resolutely to the unchanging fundamentals allows the freedom to innovate without limit. The importance of memory in making change meaningful. Judaism places much value on memory. Blessings during the holidays always mention memory. And Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, is also called the Day of Memory. Why is memory so important? Without memory, the passage of time becomes meaningless. Without memory, even music can no longer be heard. Don't forget, you can actually hear only one note at a time. You are capable only of hearing exactly what is being played at the instant. For a tune to be heard in your brain, you have to employ memory, just as you need memory to make sense of a novel you may be reading. It is memories that make change meaningful. Just think about it. Without memory, there would be no change in your life, just as there would be no music. Each moment would stand alone, with no relationship to any preceding instant or to any successive event. You need to understand the seamless interconnectivity of time in order to allow the past to guide your present actions and so to give you the future you seek. Therein lies the secret to living with change. It is sometimes difficult to remember how little does change. Part of the reason for the confusion is technology. Many more and far greater technological advances have occurred since World War II than occurred during the previous 1,000 years. It is easy to suppose that technology is totally changing everything. Of course, present-day human beings are far less dependent on the harsh whims of nature. It is wonderful to be able to have my dentist drill my tooth painlessly while I'm on Novocaine. It is wonderful to be able to talk to people on the other side of the world and to cross the United States in 5 hours.
I love air conditioning, and I love my car that starts up every time I turn the key and can travel 20,000 miles between tune-ups. But is my life really that different from that of my great-grandparents?
In certain ways, technology doesn't change things as much as it camouflages just how little things